For now, nothing requires that we go down such a path. So far, the only life in the solar system is that which comes from Earth. In the Uranus and Neptune systems, the only sign of life has been Voyager itself. As we identify the planets of other stars, as we find other worlds of roughly the size and mass of the Earth, we will scrutinize them for life. A dense oxygen atmosphere may be detectable even on a world we've never imaged. As for the Earth, that may by itself be a sign of life. An oxygen atmosphere with appreciable quantities of methane would almost certainly be a sign of life, as would modulated radio emission. Someday, from observations of our planetary system, or another, the news of life elsewhere may be announced over the morning coffee. The Voyager spacecraft are bound for the stars. They are on escape trajectories from the solar system, barreling along at almost 1,000,000 miles a day. The gravitational fields of Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune have flung them at such high speeds that they have broken the bonds that once tied them to the sun. Have they left the solar system yet? The answer depends very much on how you define the boundary of the sun's realm. If it's the orbit of the outermost good-sized planet, then the Voyager spacecraft are already long gone. There are probably no undiscovered Neptunes. If you mean the outermost planet, it may be that there are other, perhaps Triton-like planets far beyond Neptune and Pluto. If so, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 are still within the solar system. If you define the outer limits of the solar system as the heliopause, where the interplanetary particles and magnetic fields are replaced by their interstellar counterparts, then neither Voyager has yet left the solar system, although they may do so in the next few decades. But if your definition of the edge of the solar system is the distance at which our star can no longer hold worlds in orbit about it, then the Voyagers will not leave the solar system for hundreds of centuries. Weakly grasped by the sun's gravity, in every direction in the sky, is that immense hoard of 1,000,000,000,000 comets or more, the Oort cloud. The two spacecraft will finish their passage through the Oort cloud in another 20,000 years or so. Then, at last, completing their long goodbye to the solar system, broken free of the gravitational shackles that once bound them to the sun, the Voyagers will make for the open sea of interstellar space. Only then will phase two of their mission begin. Their radio transmitters, long dead, the spacecraft will wander for ages in the calm, cold, interstellar blackness, where there is almost nothing to erode them. Once out of the solar system, they will remain intact for 1,000,000,000 years or more as they circumnavigate the center of the Milky Way galaxy. We do not know whether there are other spacefaring civilizations in the Milky Way. If they do exist, we do not know how abundant they are, much less where they are. But there is at least a chance that sometime in the remote future, one of the Voyagers will be intercepted and examined by an alien craft. Accordingly, as each Voyager left Earth for the planets and the stars, it carried with it a golden phonograph record encased in a golden mirrored jacket containing, among other things, greetings in 59 human languages and one whale language, a 12-minute sound essay, including a kiss, a baby's cry, and an EEG record of the meditations of a young woman in love. 116 encoded pictures on our science, our civilization, and ourselves. And 90 minutes of the Earth's greatest hits. Eastern and Western, classical and folk, including a Navajo night chant, a Japanese shakuhachi piece, a pygmy girl's initiation song, a Peruvian wedding song, a 3,000-year-old composition for the chin called Flowing Streams, Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, Stravinsky, Louis Armstrong, Blind Willie Johnson, and Chuck Berry's Johnny B. Goode. Space is nearly empty. There is virtually no chance that one of the Voyagers will ever enter another solar system. And this is true even if every star in the sky is accompanied by planets. The instructions on the record jackets, written in what we believe to be readily comprehensible scientific hieroglyphics, can be read, and the contents of the records understood only if alien beings somewhere in the remote future find Voyager in the depths of interstellar space. Since both Voyagers will circle the center of the Milky Way galaxy essentially forever, there is plenty of time for the records to be found, if there's anyone out there to do the finding. We cannot know how much of the records they would understand. Surely the greetings will be incomprehensible, but their intent may not be. We thought it would be impolite not to say hello. The hypothetical aliens are bound to be very different from us, independently evolved on another world. Are we really sure they could understand anything at all of our message? Every time I feel these concerns stirring, though, I reassure myself. Whatever the incomprehensibilities of the Voyager record, any alien ship that finds it will have another standard by which to judge us. Each Voyager is itself a message in their exploratory intent, in the lofty ambition of their objectives, in their utter lack of intent to do harm, and in the brilliance of their design and performance, these robots speak eloquently for us. But being much more advanced scientists and engineers than we, otherwise, they would never be able to find and retrieve the small, silent spacecraft in interstellar space. Perhaps the aliens would have no difficulty understanding what is encoded on these golden records. Perhaps they would recognize the tentativeness of our society, the mismatch between our technology and our wisdom. Have we destroyed ourselves since launching Voyager, they might wonder? Or have we gone on to greater things? Or perhaps the records will never be intercepted. Perhaps no one in 5 billion years will ever come upon them. 5 billion years is a long time. In 5 billion years, all humans will have become extinct or evolved into other beings. None of our artifacts will have survived on Earth. The continents will have become unrecognizably altered or destroyed, and the evolution of the sun will have burned the earth to a crisp or reduced it to a whirl of atoms. Far from home, untouched by these remote events, the Voyagers, bearing the memories of a world that is no more, will fly on. Chapter 10, Sacred Black. Deep sky is, of all visual impressions, the nearest akin to a feeling. Samuel Taylor Coleridge, Notebooks, 1805. the blue of a cloudless May morning, or the reds and oranges of a sunset at sea, have roused humans to wonder, to poetry, and to science. No matter where on earth we live, no matter what our language, customs, or politics, we share a sky in common. Most of us expect that azure blue, and would for good reason be stunned to wake up one sunrise to find a cloudless sky that was black, or yellow, or green. Inhabitants of Los Angeles and Mexico City have grown accustomed to brown skies, and those of London and Seattle to gray ones. But even they still consider blue the planetary norm. And yet, there are worlds with black or yellow skies, and maybe even green. The color of the sky characterizes the world. Plop me down on any planet in the solar system without sensing the gravity, without glimpsing the ground. Let me take a quick look at the sun and sky, and I can, I think, pretty well tell you where I am. That familiar shade of blue, interrupted here and there by fleecy white clouds, is a signature of our world. The French have an expression, sacre bleu, which translates roughly as good heavens. Literally, it means sacred blue. Indeed, if there ever is a true flag of earth, this should be its color. Birds fly through it, clouds are suspended in it, humans admire and routinely traverse it. Light from the sun and stars flutters through it. But what is it? What is it made of? Where does it end? How much of it is there? Where does all that blue come from? If it's a commonplace for all humans, if it typifies our world, surely we should know something about it. What is the sky? In August 1957, for the first time, a human being rose above the blue and looked around when David Simons, a retired Air Force officer and a physician, became the highest human in history. Alone, he piloted a balloon to an altitude of over 100,000 feet, 30 kilometers, and through his thick windows, glimpsed a different sky. Now a professor at the University of California Medical School in Irvine, Dr. Simons recalls it was a dark, deep purple overhead. He had reached the transition region where the blue of the ground level is being overtaken by the perfect black of space. Since Simons' almost forgotten flight, people of many nations have flown above the atmosphere. It is now clear from repeated and direct human and robotic experience that in space, the daytime sky is black. The sun shines brightly on your ship. The earth below you is brilliantly illuminated, but the sky above is black as night. Here is the memorable description by Yuri Gagarin of what he saw on the first spaceflight of the human species aboard Vostok 1, on April 12, 1961. The sky is completely black, and against the background of this black sky, the stars appear somewhat brighter and more distinct. The Earth has a very characteristic, very beautiful blue halo, which is seen well when you observe the horizon. There is a smooth color transition from tender blue, to dark blue and purple, and then to the completely black color of the sky. It is a very beautiful transition. Clearly, the day-lit sky, all that blue, is somehow connected with the air. But as you look across the breakfast table, your companion is not usually blue. The color of the sky must be a property not of a little air, but of a great deal. If you look closely at the Earth from space, You see it surrounded by a thin band of blue, as thick as the lower atmosphere. Indeed, it is the lower atmosphere. At the top of that band, you can make out the blue sky fading into the blackness of space. This is the transition zone that Simons was the first to enter, and Gagarin the first to observe from above. In routine spaceflight, you start at the bottom of the blue, penetrate entirely through it a few minutes after liftoff, and then enter that boundless realm where a simple breath of air is impossible without elaborate life support systems. Human life depends for its very existence on that blue sky. We are right to consider it tender and sacred. We see the blue in daytime because sunlight is bouncing off the air around and above us. On a cloudless night, the sky is black because there is no sufficiently intense source of light to be reflected off the air. Somehow, the air preferentially bounces blue light down to us. How? The visible light from the sun comes in many colors. Violet, blue, green, yellow, orange, red, corresponding to light of different wavelengths. A wavelength is the distance from crest to crest as the wave travels through air or space. Violet and blue light waves have the shortest wavelengths, orange and red the longest. What we perceive as color is how our eyes and brains read the wavelengths of light. We might just as reasonably translate wavelengths of light into, say, heard tones rather than seen colors. But that's not how our senses evolved. When all those rainbow colors of the spectrum are mixed together, as in sunlight, they seem almost white. These waves travel together in 8 minutes across the intervening 93 million miles, or 150 million kilometers, of space from the sun to the earth. They strike the atmosphere, which is made mostly of nitrogen and oxygen molecules. Some waves are reflected by the air back into space. Some are bounced around before the light reaches the ground, and they can be detected by a passing eyeball. Also, some bounce off clouds or the ground back into space. This bouncing around of light waves in the atmosphere is called scattering. But not all waves are equally well scattered by the molecules of air. Wavelengths that are much longer than the size of the molecules are scattered less. They spill over the molecules, hardly influenced by their presence. Wavelengths that are closer to the size of the molecules are scattered more. And waves have trouble ignoring obstacles as big as they are. You can see this in water waves scattered by the pilings of piers or bathtub waves from a dripping faucet encountering a rubber duck. The shorter wavelengths, those that we sense as violet and blue light, are more efficiently scattered than the longer wavelengths, those that we sense as orange and red light. When we look up on a cloudless day and admire the blue sky, we are witnessing the preferential scattering of the short waves in sunlight. This is called Rayleigh scattering, after the English physicist who offered the first coherent explanation for it. Cigarette smoke is blue for just the same reason. The particles that make it up are about as small as the wavelength of blue light. So why is the sunset red? The red of the sunset is what's left of sunlight after the air scatters the blue away. Since the atmosphere is a thin shell of gravitationally bound gas surrounding the solid Earth, sunlight must pass through a longer slant path of air at sunset or sunrise than at noon. Since the violet and blue waves are scattered even more during their now longer path through the air than when the sun is overhead, what we see when we look toward the sun is the residue, the waves of sunlight that are hardly scattered away at all, especially the oranges and reds. A blue sky makes a red sunset. The noontime sun seemed yellowish, partly because it emits slightly more yellow light than other colors, and partly because even with the sun overhead, some blue light is scattered out of the sunbeams by the Earth's atmosphere. It is sometimes said that scientists are unromantic, that their passion to figure out robs the world of beauty and mystery. But is it not stirring to understand how the world actually works? That white light is made of colors, that color is the way we perceive the wavelengths of light, that transparent air reflects light, that in so doing it discriminates among the waves, and that the sky is blue for the same reason that the sunset is red. It does no harm to the romance of the sunset to know a little bit about it. Since most simple molecules are about the same size, roughly 1/100,000,000th of a centimeter, the blue of the Earth's sky doesn't much depend on what the air is made of, as long as the air doesn't absorb the light. Oxygen and nitrogen molecules don't absorb visible light. They only bounce it away in some other direction. Other molecules, though, can gobble up the light. Oxides of nitrogen, produced in automotive engines and in the fires of industry, are a source of the murky brown coloration of smog. Oxides of nitrogen, made from oxygen and nitrogen, do absorb light. Absorption, as well as scattering, can color a sky. Other worlds, other skies. Mercury, the Earth's moon, and most satellites of the other planets are small worlds. Because of their feeble gravities, they are unable to retain their atmospheres, which instead trickle off into space. The near vacuum of space then reaches the ground. Sunlight strikes their surfaces unimpeded, neither scattered nor absorbed along the way. The skies of these worlds are black, even at noon. This has been witnessed firsthand so far by only 12 humans, the lunar landing crews of Apollos 11, 12, and 14 through 17. All have black skies, except Titan of Saturn and perhaps Triton of Neptune, which are big enough to have atmospheres, and all asteroids as well. Venus has about 90 times more air than Earth. It isn't mainly oxygen and nitrogen, as here, it's carbon dioxide. But carbon dioxide doesn't absorb visible light either. What would the sky look like from the surface of Venus if Venus had no clouds? With so much atmosphere in the way, not only are violet and blue waves scattered, but all the other colors as well, green, yellow, orange, red. The air is so thick, though, that hardly any blue light makes it to the ground. It's scattered back to space by successive bounces higher up. Thus, the light that does reach the ground should be strongly reddened, like an Earth sunset all over the sky. Further, sulfur in the high clouds will stain the sky yellow. Pictures taken by the Soviet Venera landers confirm that the skies of Venus are a kind of yellow-orange. Mars is a different story. It is a smaller world than Earth, with a much thinner atmosphere. The pressure at the surface of Mars is, in fact, about the same as the altitude in the Earth's stratosphere, to which Simons rose. So we might expect the Martian sky to be black or purple-black. The first color picture from the surface of Mars was obtained in July 1976 by the American Viking 1 lander, the first spacecraft to touch down successfully on the surface of the red planet. The digital data were dutifully radioed from Mars back to Earth and the color picture assembled by computer. To the surprise of all the scientists, and nobody else, That first image released to the press showed the Martian sky to be a comfortable, homey blue. Impossible for a planet with so insubstantial an atmosphere. Something had gone wrong. The picture on your color television set is a mixture of three monochrome images, each in a different color of light, red, green, and blue. You can see this method of color compositing in video projection systems which project separate beams of red, green, and blue light to generate a full color picture, including yellows. To get the right color, your set needs to mix or balance these three monochrome images correctly. If you turn up the intensity of, say, blue, the picture will appear too blue. Any picture returned from space requires a similar color balance. Considerable discretion is sometimes left to the computer analysts in deciding this balance. The Viking analysts were not planetary astronomers, and with this first color picture from Mars, they simply mixed the colors until it looked right. We are so conditioned by our experience on Earth that right, of course, means a blue sky. The color of the picture was soon corrected using color calibration standards placed for this very purpose on board the spacecraft, and the resulting composite showed no blue sky at all. Rather, it was something between ochre and pink. Not blue, but hardly purple-black either. This is the right color of the Martian sky. Much of the surface of Mars is desert and red because the sands are rusty. There are occasional violent sandstorms that lift fine particles from the surface high into the atmosphere. It takes a long time for them to fall out, and before the sky has fully cleaned itself, there's always another sandstorm. Global or near-global sandstorms occur almost every Martian year. Since rusty particles are always suspended in this sky, future generations of humans, born and living out their lives on Mars, will consider that salmon color to be as natural and familiar as we consider our homey blue. From a single glance at the daytime sky, they'll probably be able to tell how long it's been since the last big sandstorm. The planets in the outer solar system, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, are of a different sort. These are huge worlds with giant atmospheres made mainly of hydrogen and helium. Their solid surfaces are so deep inside that no sunlight penetrates there at all. Down there, the sky is black, with no prospect of a sunrise, not ever. The perpetual starless night is perhaps illuminated on occasion by a bolt of lightning. But higher in the atmosphere, where the sunlight reaches, a much more beautiful vista awaits. On Jupiter, above a high-altitude haze layer composed of ammonia rather than water ice particles, the sky is almost black. Farther down in the blue sky region are multicolored clouds in various shades of yellow-brown and of unknown composition. The candidate materials include sulfur, phosphorus, and complex organic molecules. Even farther down, the sky will appear red-brown, except that the clouds there are of varying thicknesses, and where they are thin, you might see a patch of blue. Still deeper, we gradually return to perpetual night. Something similar is true on Saturn, but the colors there are much more muted. Uranus, and especially Neptune, have an uncanny, austere blue color through which clouds, some of them a little whiter, are carried by high-speed winds. Sunlight reaches a comparatively clean atmosphere composed mainly of hydrogen and helium, but also rich in methane. Long paths of methane absorb yellow and especially red light and let the green and blue filter through. A thin hydrocarbon haze removes a little blue. There may be a depth where the sky is greenish. Conventional wisdom holds that the absorption by methane and the Rayleigh scattering of sunlight by the deep atmosphere together account for the blue colors on Uranus and Neptune. But analysis of Voyager data by Kevin Baines of JPL seems to show that these causes are insufficient. Apparently very deep, maybe in the vicinity of hypothesized clouds of hydrogen sulfide, there is an abundant blue substance. So far, no one has been able to figure out what it might be. Blue materials are very rare in nature. As always happens in science, the old mysteries are dispelled, only to be replaced by new ones. Sooner or later, we'll find out the answer to this one, too. All worlds with non-black skies have atmospheres. If you're standing on the surface, and there's an atmosphere thick enough to see, there's probably a way to fly through it. We're now sending our instruments to fly in the variously colored skies of other worlds. Someday, we will go ourselves. Parachutes have already been used in the atmospheres of Venus and Mars, and are planned for Jupiter and Titan. In 1985, two French-Soviet balloons sailed through the yellow skies of Venus. The Vega 1 balloon, about 4 meters across, dangled an instrument package 13 meters below. The balloon inflated in the night hemisphere, floated about 54 kilometers above the surface, and transmitted data for almost 2 Earth days before its batteries failed. In that time, it traveled 11,600 kilometers, nearly 7,000 miles, over the surface of Venus, far below. The Vega 2 balloon had an almost identical profile. The atmosphere of Venus has also been used for aerobraking, changing the Magellan spacecraft's orbit by friction with the dense air. This is a key future technology for converting flyby spacecraft to Mars into orbiters and landers. A Mars mission, scheduled to be launched in 1998 and led by Russia, includes an enormous French hot air balloon looking something like a vast jellyfish, a Portuguese man of war. It's designed to sink to the Martian surface every chilly twilight and rise high when heated by sunlight the next day. The winds are so fast that if all goes well, it will be carried hundreds of kilometers each day, hopping and skipping over the North Pole. In the early morning, when close to the ground, it will obtain very high-resolution pictures and other data. The balloon has an instrumental guide rope, essential for its stability, conceived and designed by a private membership organization based in Pasadena, California, the Planetary Society. Since the surface pressure on Mars is approximately that at an altitude of 100,000 feet on Earth, we know we can fly airplanes there. The U-2, for example, or the SR-71 Blackbird, routinely approaches such low pressures. Aircraft with even larger wingspans have been designed for Mars. The dream of flight and the dream of space travel are twins, conceived by similar visionaries, dependent on allied technologies, and evolving more or less in tandem. As certain practical and economic limits to flight on Earth are reached, the possibility arises of flying through the multi-hued skies of other worlds. It is now almost possible to assign color combinations based on the colors of clouds and sky to every planet in the solar system. From the sulfur-stained skies of Venus and the rusty skies of Mars to the aquamarine of Uranus and the hypnotic and unearthly blue of Neptune. Sacre Jean, Sacre Rouge, Sacre Vert. Perhaps they will one day adorn the flags of distant human outposts in the solar system. In that time, when the new frontiers are sweeping out from the sun to the stars, and the explorers are surrounded by the endless black of space. Sacre Noir. Chapter 11. Evening and Morning Star. This is another world, which is not of men. Li Bai. Question and Answer in the Mountains. China. Tang Dynasty. Circa 730. You can see it shining brilliantly in the twilight, chasing the sun down below the western horizon. Upon first glimpsing it each night, people were accustomed to make a wish upon a star. Sometimes the wish came true. Or you can spy it in the east before dawn, fleeing the rising sun. In these two incarnations, brighter than anything else in the sky except only the sun and the moon, it was known as the evening and the morning star. Our ancestors did not recognize it was a world, the same world, never too far from the sun because it is in an orbit about it interior to the Earth's. Just before sunset, or just after sunrise, we can sometimes see it near some fluffy white cloud, and then discover, by the comparison, that Venus has a color, a pale lemon yellow. You peer through the eyepiece of a telescope, even a big telescope, even the largest optical telescope on Earth, and you can make out no detail at all. Over the months, you see a featureless disk methodically going through phases, like the moon, crescent Venus, full Venus, gibbous Venus, new Venus. There is not a hint of continents or oceans. Some of the first astronomers to see Venus through the telescope immediately recognized that they were examining a world enshrouded by clouds. The clouds, we now know, are droplets of concentrated sulfuric acid stained yellow by a little elemental sulfur. They lie high above the ground. In ordinary visible light, there's no hint of what this planet's surface, some 50 kilometers below the cloud tops, is like. And for centuries, the best we had were wild guesses. You might conjecture that if we could take a much finer look, there might be breaks in the clouds, revealing day by day in bits and pieces the mysterious surface ordinarily hidden from our view. Then the time of guesses would be over. The Earth is on average half cloud covered. In the early days of Venus exploration, we saw no reason that Venus should be 100% overcast. If instead it was only 90% or even 99% cloud covered, the transient patches of clearing might tell us much. In 1960 and 1961, Mariners 1 and 2, the first American spacecraft designed to visit Venus, were being prepared. There were those, like me, who thought the ship should carry video cameras so they could radio pictures back to Earth. The same technology would be used a few years later when Rangers 7, 8, and 9 would photograph the moon on the way to their crash landings, the last making a bullseye in the crater Alphonsus. But time was short for the Venus mission, and cameras were heavy. There were those who maintained that cameras weren't really scientific instruments, but rather catch-as-catch-can, razzle-dazzle, pandering to the public, and unable to answer a single straightforward, well-posed, scientific question. I thought myself that whether there are breaks in the clouds was one such question. I argued that cameras could also answer questions that we were too dumb even to pose. I argued that pictures were the only way to show the public, who were, after all, footing the bill, the excitement of robotic missions. At any rate, no camera was flown, and subsequent missions have, for this particular world, at least partly vindicated that judgment. Even at high resolution from close flybys, invisible light, it turns out there are no breaks in the clouds of Venus any more than in the clouds of Titan. These worlds are permanently overcast. For Titan, imaging revealed a succession of detached hazes above the main layer of aerosols. So Venus works out to be the only world in the solar system for which spacecraft cameras working in ordinary visible light haven't discovered something important. Happily, we've now returned pictures from almost every world we've visited. NASA's Intercometary Explorer, which raced through the tail of Comet Giacobini-Zimmer in 1985, flew blind, being devoted to charged particles and magnetic fields. In the ultraviolet, there is detail. But due to transient patches of high-altitude overcast, far above the main cloud deck. The high clouds race around the planet much faster than the planet itself turns. Super rotation. We have an even smaller chance of seeing the surface in the ultraviolet. When it became clear that the atmosphere of Venus was much thicker than the air on Earth, as we now know, the pressure at the surface is 90 times what it is here. It immediately followed that in ordinary visible light, we could not possibly see the surface, even if there were breaks in the clouds. What little sunlight is able to make its tortuous way through the dense atmosphere to the surface would be reflected back all right, but the photons would be so jumbled by repeated scattering off molecules in the lower air that no image of surface features could be retained. It would be like a whiteout in a polar snowstorm. However, this effect, intense Rayleigh scattering, declines rapidly with increasing wavelength. In the near infrared, it was easy to calculate you could see the surface if there were breaks in the clouds, or if the clouds were transparent there. So in 1970, Jim Pollack, Dave Morrison and I went to the McDonald Observatory of the University of Texas to try to observe Venus in the near infrared. We hypersensitized out emulsions. The good old-fashioned glass photographic plates were treated with ammonia and sometimes heated or briefly illuminated before being exposed at the telescope to light from Venus. For a time, the cellars of McDonald Observatory reeked of ammonia. We took many pictures. None showed any detail. We concluded that either we hadn't gone far enough into the infrared, or the clouds of Venus were opaque and unbroken in the near infrared. More than 20 years later, the Galileo spacecraft, making a close flyby of Venus, examined it with higher resolution and sensitivity, and at wavelengths a little further into the infrared than we were able to reach with our crude glass emulsions. Galileo photographed great mountain ranges. We already knew of their existence, though. A much more powerful technique had earlier been employed, radar. Radio waves effortlessly penetrate the clouds and thick atmosphere of Venus, bounce off the surface, and return to Earth, where they are gathered in and used to make a picture. The first work had been done, chiefly by American ground-based radar, at JPL's Goldstone tracking station in the Mojave Desert, and at the Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico, operated by Cornell University. Then, the U.S. Pioneer 12, the Soviet Venera 15 and 16, and the U.S. Magellan missions inserted radar telescopes into orbit around Venus and mapped the place, pole to pole. Each spacecraft would transmit a radar signal to the surface and then catch it as it bounced back. from how reflective each patch of surface was, and how long it took the signal to return. Shorter from mountains, longer from valleys. A detailed map of the entire surface was slowly and painstakingly constructed. The world so revealed turns out to be uniquely sculpted by lava flows, and to a much lesser degree, by wind, as described in the next chapter. The clouds and atmosphere of Venus have now become transparent to us, and another world has been visited by the doughty robot explorers from Earth. Our experience with Venus is now being applied elsewhere, especially to Titan, where once again, impenetrable clouds hide an enigmatic surface, and radar is beginning to give us hints of what might lie below. Venus had long been thought of as our sister world. It is the nearest planet to the Earth. It has almost the same mass, size, density, and gravitational pull as the Earth does. It's a little closer to the Sun than the Earth, but its bright clouds reflect more sunlight back to space than our clouds do. As a first guess, you might very well imagine that under those unbroken clouds, Venus was rather like Earth. Early scientific speculation included fetid swamps crawling with monster amphibians, like the Earth in the Carboniferous period. A world desert, a global petroleum sea, and a seltzer ocean dotted here and there with limestone-encrusted islands. While based on some scientific data, these models of Venus, the first dating from the beginnings of the century, the second from the 1930s, and the last two from the mid-1950s, were little more than scientific romances, hardly constrained by the sparse data available. Then, in 1956, a report was published in the Astrophysical Journal by Cornell H. Meyer and his colleagues. They had pointed a newly completed radio telescope, built in part for classified research, on the roof of the Naval Research Laboratory in Washington, D.C., at Venus, and measured the flux of radio waves arriving at Earth. This was not radar. No radio waves were bounced off Venus. This was listening to radio waves that Venus on its own emits to space. Venus turned out to be much brighter than the background of distant stars and galaxies. This in itself was not very surprising. Every object warmer than absolute zero, minus 273 degrees Celsius, gives off radiation throughout the electromagnetic spectrum, including the radio region. You, for example, emit radio waves at an effective or brightness temperature of about 35 degrees Celsius. And if you were in surroundings colder than you are, a sensitive radio telescope could detect the faint radio waves you are transmitting in all directions. Each of us is a source of cold static. What was surprising about Meyer's discovery was that the brightness temperature of Venus is more than 300 degrees Celsius, far higher than the surface temperature of the Earth or the measured infrared temperature of the clouds of Venus. Some places on Venus seemed at least 200 degrees hotter than the normal boiling point of water. What could this mean? Soon, there was a deluge of explanations. I argued that the high radio brightness temperature was a direct indication of a hot surface, and that the high temperatures were due to a massive carbon dioxide water vapor greenhouse effect, in which some sunlight is transmitted through the clouds and heats the surface, but the surface experiences enormous difficulty in radiating back to space because of the high infrared opacity of carbon dioxide and water vapor. Carbon dioxide absorbs at a range of wavelengths through the infrared, but there seem to be windows between the CO2 absorption bands through which the surface could readily cool off to space. Water vapor, though, absorbs at infrared frequencies that correspond in part to the windows in the carbon dioxide opacity. The two gases together, it seemed to me, could pretty well absorb almost all the infrared emission, even if there was very little water vapor. Something like two picket fences, the slats of one, being fortuitously positioned to cover the gaps of the other. There was another very different category of explanation in which the high brightness temperature of Venus had nothing to do with the ground. The surface could still be temperate, clement, congenial. It was proposed that some region in the atmosphere of Venus or in its surrounding magnetosphere emitted these radio waves to space. Electrical discharges between water droplets in the Venus clouds were suggested. A glow discharge in which ions and electrons recombined at twilight and dawn in the upper atmosphere was offered. A very dense ionosphere had its advocates, in which the mutual acceleration of unbound electrons, free emission, gave off radio waves. One proponent of this idea even suggested that the high ionization required was due to an average of 10,000 times greater radioactivity on Venus than on Earth, perhaps from a recent nuclear war there. And in the light of the discovery of radiation from Jupiter's magnetosphere, it was natural to suggest that the radio emission came from an immense cloud of charged particles trapped by some hypothetical, very intense Venusian magnetic field. In a series of papers I published in the middle 1960s, many in collaboration with Jim Pollock, these conflicting models of a high, hot, emitting region and a cold surface were subjected to a critical analysis. By then, we had two important new clues: the radio spectrum of Venus and the Mariner 2 evidence that the radio emission was more intense at the center of the disk of Venus than toward its edge. By 1967, we were able to exclude the alternative models with some confidence and conclude that the surface of Venus was at a scorching and unearth-like temperature in excess of 400 degrees Celsius. But the argument was inferential, and there were many intermediate steps. We longed for a more direct measurement. In October 1967, commemorating the 10th anniversary of Sputnik 1, the Soviet Venera 4 spacecraft dropped an entry capsule into the clouds of Venus. It returned data from the hot lower atmosphere, but did not survive to the surface. One day later, the United States spacecraft Mariner 5 flew by Venus, its radio transmission to Earth skimming the atmosphere at progressively greater depths. The rate of fading of the signal gave information about atmospheric temperatures. Although there seemed to be some discrepancies, later resolved, between the two sets of spacecraft data, both clearly indicated that the surface of Venus is very hot. Since then, a progression of Soviet Venera spacecraft and one cluster of American spacecraft from the Pioneer 12 mission have entered the deep atmosphere or landed on the surface and measured directly, essentially by sticking out a thermometer, the surface and near-surface temperatures. They turn out to be about 470 degrees Celsius, almost 900 degrees Fahrenheit. When such factors as calibration errors of terrestrial radio telescopes and surface emissivity are taken into account, the old radio observations and the new direct spacecraft measurements turn out to be in good accord. Early Soviet landers were designed for an atmosphere somewhat like our own. They were crushed by the high pressures like a tin can in the grasp of a champion arm wrestler or a World War II submarine in the Tonga Trench. Thereafter, Soviet Venus entry vehicles were heavily reinforced, like modern submarines, and successfully landed on the searing surface. When it became clear how deep the atmosphere is and how thick the clouds, Soviet designers became concerned that the surface might be pitch black. Veneras 9 and 10 were equipped with floodlights. They proved unnecessary. A few percent of the sunlight that falls on the top of the clouds makes it through to the surface, and Venus is about as bright as on a cloudy day on Earth. The resistance to the idea of a hot surface on Venus can, I suppose, be attributed to our reluctance to abandon the notion that the nearest planet is hospitable for life, for future exploration, and perhaps even in the longer term, for human settlement. As it turns out, there are no carboniferous swamps, no global oil or seltzer oceans. Instead, Venus is a stifling, brooding inferno. There are some deserts, but it's mainly a world of frozen lava seas. Our hopes are unfulfilled. The call of this world is now more muted than in the early days of a spacecraft exploration, when almost anything was possible, and our most romantic notions about Venus might, for all we then knew, be realized. Many spacecraft contributed to our present understanding of Venus, but the pioneering mission was Mariner 2. Mariner 1 failed at launch and, as they say of a racehorse with a broken leg, had to be destroyed. Mariner 2 worked beautifully and provided the key early radio data on the climate of Venus. It made infrared observations of the properties of the clouds. On its way from Earth to Venus, it discovered and measured the solar wind, the stream of charged particles that flows outward from the sun, filling the magnetospheres of any planets in its way, blowing back the tails of comets, and establishing the distant heliopause. Mariner 2 was the first successful planetary probe, the ship that ushered in the age of planetary exploration. It's still in orbit around the sun, every few hundred days still approaching, more or less tangentially, the orbit of Venus. Each time that happens, Venus isn't there. But if we wait long enough, Venus will one day be nearby, and Mariner 2 will be accelerated by the planet's gravity into some quite different orbit. Ultimately, Mariner 2, like some planetesimal from ages past, will be swept up by another planet, fall into the sun, or be ejected from the solar system. Until then, this harbinger of the age of planetary exploration, this minuscule artificial planet, will continue silently orbiting the sun. It's a little as if Columbus's flagship, the Santa Maria, were still making regular runs with a ghostly crew across the Atlantic between Cadiz and Hispaniola. In the vacuum of interplanetary space, Mariner 2 should be in mint condition for many generations. My wish on the evening and morning star is this, that late in the 21st century, some great ship, on its regular gravity-assisted transit to the outer solar system, intercepts this ancient derelict and heaves it aboard, so it can be displayed in a museum of early space technology. On Mars, perhaps, or Europa, or Iapetus. Chapter 12, The Ground Melts. Midway through Thera and Therasia, fires broke forth from the sea and continued for 4 days, so that the whole sea boiled and blazed, and the fires cast up an island, which was gradually elevated as though by levers. After the cessation of the eruption, the Rhodians, at the time of their maritime supremacy, were first to venture upon the scene and to erect on the island a temple. Strabo, Geography, circa 7 BC. All over the Earth, you can find a kind of mountain with one striking and unusual feature. Any child can recognize it. The top